This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Five New York teenagers were wrongly convicted of raping a woman in Central Park in 1989. They were mistreated and manipulated and convicted on coerced convictions and confessions and spent 6 to 13 years in prison. Most people know them as the Central Park Five, but a newly dramatized series from Ava DuVernay challenges viewers to see each man in his own humanity.
Who you were in the park with?
I don't know names. I just got lost.
Where did you see the lady?
One lady.
The female jogger was severely beaten and raped. Every black male who was in the park last night is a suspect. I need all of them.
When They See Us is a four-part Netflix series that traces the stories of Raymond Santana, Corey Wise, Antron McRae, Yusef Salaam, and Kevin Richardson. Their stories have been told before in various ways, but this rendition is garnering unprecedented global attention and is currently one of the most popular on Netflix, and one of the many topics we'll cover today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we're going to talk about a private rec center in Wake County that's accused of racist pool rules and reflect on 30 years of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Plus, we review a new documentary about the Black Godfather, Clarence Avant. Today, joining us in the conversation, Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State. Natalie, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and the host of the webcast, Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
Let's talk about this series. Natalie, what was your sense, your reaction to this?
So, you know, I became probably more aware of the Central Park Five, now we should call them the Exonerated Five because that's what they are, through the documentary about them that was done by Ken Burns' daughter, Sarah Burns, some years back. I mean, I'm old enough to have been of age when this happened. So I remember, you know, bits and pieces of the news coverage, but there is something about seeing a feature film that's scripted, that is dramatizing these events, and especially when it's at the hands of Ava DuVernay, who's a masterful storyteller, that is just emotionally devastating. I was just telling Mark that I have not seen the last episode because I cannot get myself to the point where I can watch what happens to Corey Wise. But even just watching the first few episodes, there really are no words for to express how I feel and how horrific it was to watch this dramatization of what happened to these young boys, because that's what they were boys. And of course, as a mother who has a 16-year-old son, black son, you know, I'm thinking this could happen, this is what happens to young black men, young black boys, men, girls, women. I mean, it's never ending. So I feel it's very important that we bear witness to what happened to these young boys, now men. But it's really emotionally challenging to sit through it.
Mark?
I was a 20-something still living in New York City when the case occurred. And the thing I remember that struck me the most in the beginning is that they were accused of wilding. And as someone who was relatively still close in age to their age, it struck me as odd because I had never heard that term before ever uttered by groups of young black men. And I always suspected at the time, because this really was, the case was my introduction to developing media literacy. Mm-hmm. My sense is that there are a bunch of kids running around Central Park that night probably singing Tone Loc's Wild Thing, quite honestly, which just made much more sense to me than running around doing something called wilding. What I also remember about that moment that comes out, I think, in the context of seeing Ava DuVernay's incredible, you know, four-part series, is that because the newsrooms were so white, because national media was so white, because the judicial system was so white, there were no advocates for those young boys in those cases, either on the criminal justice side or in terms of the public opinion side. Mm-hmm. There was no internet, right? Mm-hmm. There were no platforms other than places like the Amsterdam News and the City Sun and black-owned newspapers in New York City. You got very little commentary that talked about the kind of holes in this case and why it was so problematic. It's the reason why, you know, a then, you know, developer by the name of Donald Trump could take out a full-page ad, right, and suggest that they face the death penalty without there being any real pushback by other media folks in New York City at the time. Yeah.
Everybody completely prepared, or so many people completely prepared to believe the story that was concocted by the prosecution and the police. And let's listen to a clip now from episode one of the series. Starts by setting up who the boys and the families are, and of course the vulnerability that allows each of them to be coerced into a confession later on. Here's a scene between Antron McCray and his father, who is trying to talk with Antron while Antron, who's one of the young men, while he's in custody.
Listen to me, Tron. I need you to do what the police want you to do. You gotta say what they want you to say.
They want me to lie.
I don't think of it like that. Just say what they want you to say.
Damn. I ain't raped no lady,
Tron. Tron, these police will mess us up. They not playing. They not. Look, when the police want what they want, they will do anything. Do you hear me? Anything. Lie on us. They will lock us up. They will kill us. I ain't gonna let them kill my son.
Khalil Harris and Michael Williams playing Antron and Bobby McCray in the new four-part Netflix series about the Central Park Five called When They See Us, directed and produced, co-written by Ava DuVernay. I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, let me stick with you for a minute. Your reaction to that scene?
That scene was heartbreaking on a couple of levels. One, and you know, Antron is still carrying really the weight of his father's decision that period of time, right? And so you understand how hurtful it must have been him as a young boy to have to own up to something that he didn't do. At the same time, it's so tragic for his father, who's a byproduct of a totally different world, right? Where that was simply, as a black man, which you always knew that you had to do if they accuse you, right? There was no way to fight that. And in fact, what's going to happen to you will be far worse if you didn't go along with the story than if you actually tried to tell the truth of the story. And it's that way in which the film talks about the ways that there were no choices for these boys, right? They were caught up in so many different directions, had no agency, you know, no one who was willing to advocate for them seriously.
Yeah, and as the film points out, the Antron's father was first going to, you know, sort of insist that he not have to confess. He didn't do this, and then the police pulled dad aside,
right,
show him an old beef, and that's when they make clear to him that everything you can remember from your upbringing is going to come to bear on your life and your family if you don't give him the right advice.
Right, and, you know, kind of piggybacking off what Mark said, you know, the film, the series, I think it's so nuanced. You know, there's a lot of sort of specters, historical specters that kind of exist in the background. And so there's this history of the way that law enforcement has existed within black communities, the way that black people have experienced the police, that, you know, is understood in this moment, right? And you know, we have empathy for Antron's father because we understand where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, in theory, what he's saying is correct. But then we also, you know that, okay, when we talk about justice and whether or not someone has actually done the crime, that, you know, you can't say you did something when you didn't. You know, so there's this push and pull in that scene that is... as Mark said, extremely heartbreaking, but is just, you know, it is indicative of what Black people deal with when it comes to law enforcement on a regular basis. And it's been like that for decades.
And the persistent fallout. There was this, Oprah hosted a special on this series that included Ava DuVernay and the original five young men who have since been exonerated. And when she asked Antron if he could forgive his father, he just said no.
Mm-hmm. He hates him.
He just said no.
He hates him. And I mean, you know, this is a type of pain and trauma that this man in particular, but he is also reflective of men and boys and moms and aunts and uncles and just Black families throughout history who have had to carry this pain of what the implications of dealing with the police and being arrested and being charged and being railroaded, how all of that is a collective pain that we have to deal with. And I think that Ava, you know, one of the things that I think is so beautiful about her even taking up this story is that in her own way, she is, I mean, this is social justice work that she's doing, right? Yeah. You know, this is her way of saying, look, this is what Black people deal with on a regular basis, and we're going to reckon with it. We are going to hold people accountable in one way or another.
You talked about the nuance in all of this and the dynamics and the cross currents. There's another social justice issue that flows through all of this, and that is violence against women, which had not been taken seriously enough up until that time. And it plays an important role in this. Let's play another clip now from episode 2 that looks at how the case was built against the boys despite the lack of evidence.
So we have semen in a sock, and it isn't theirs, any of them. So what are we doing here? I'm the one who has to sell this to a jury, and the whole city is watching, hell, the country. So do you understand what is happening here?
We've still got the cervical DNA.
Which was inconclusive.
Which means the five can't be ruled out. Deal with the sock DNA results. You know, play up the cervical DNA.
Are you listening to yourself? You sound delusional. You want me to pretend that the sock never existed? This is crossing a line.
Scene from episode 2, When They See Us, and in that scene, Vera Farmiga and Felicity Huffman portray Elizabeth Lederer, veteran prosecutor who worked on the Central Park case, and former New York assistant DA Linda Fairstein, who is the chief of the sex crimes office. And she makes it clear that, you know, this is a crime against women, and they've been ignored too long, even though she's, you know, pretty complicated.
But the thing that is so interesting is that, you know, Linda Fairstein is riding for white women. She's not riding for all women, because it's been documented that there were all kinds of assaults, sexual assaults that took place against Black women in the same time period. They weren't even touched in the news. So it's you know, that even though I think part of the nuance of this other social justice issue, as you rightfully call it, is that there is this divide between how sexism and misogyny against white women is treated and the fact that Black women are often just completely invisible in those conversations.
And you see that play out in the case of the gentleman who actually owns up to the crimes, the fact that he had raped a number of Latino women in that same period of time, and the inability of the police to link those crimes to this particular case, right? Because they didn't care about those crimes. Those crimes didn't matter. And at the same time, what's important here is that even as you see this push now to think about sexual violence against white women, very specifically in this case, Black men and boys still become the de facto racists, right? Which is the irony of having developer Donald Trump make these particular claims, and now to be a sitting president who has almost 20 women who have accused him of sexual assault, right? And none of it sticks to him at all.
Right. Yeah, and he doesn't walk any of that back. Right. Even they've been exonerated, because he knows his core group loves what he's saying and will always love what he's saying. And so he doesn't feel the need to walk it back because he's not listening to them.
Yeah, but the other people who won't walk back, you know, what they did are Linda Fairstein and the prosecutor, Federer. They've doubled down on their theory that the Central Park Five were actually guilty, that they could have been involved in some sort of way, even if they didn't actually commit the crime. And so, you know, that really shows this insistence among some white people to believe the worst and to hold on to that for dear life about black boys and men.
Even in the face of truth.
Even in the face of truth, right.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is Ava DuVernay is asked on that Oprah special, you know, about Linda Fairstein, you know, and sort of what should she have gotten, you know, now she's losing her deals and there seems to be a certain amount of justice now. And Ava DuVernay said, you know, it's very much about what she did wrong. People should be held accountable and she should be held accountable and these things should be happening. But that's not the problem. As she said, our system, our legal system, this is Ava DuVernay, isn't broken. It was built that way.
That's right.
It was built that way. And if we lose focus and focus only on the individuals and their wrongdoing in this case, we will miss the point.
And I want to say this one other thing that I think is important about thinking about Ava DuVernay doing this. You know, she was one of the people that they talked about in terms of doing Black Panther. Right. In fact, they spoke with her before they spoke to Ryan Coogler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some folks were up in arms about, you know, it would have been nice to have a black woman director, you know, do this franchise piece. But if she makes Black Panther, she's not making this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, you know, there's a providence, right, to the fact that she's been able to deliver what she's delivered and have the kind of impact on this conversation, social justice, as Frank mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and one of the things she did, too, was give it the name When They See Us, because it was going to be the Central Park Five, and Oprah's one of the producers, and she talked about the fact that, you know, we were in a producers' meeting, and we talked to you, Ava, and she insisted on changing the name because it was not going to be about a collective anymore. She really wanted to focus on the individuals, something that I think the individuals involved here, the young men, picked up on. Oprah, one of the executive producers of the series, released a companion special that cast with the cast and the creator and the Exonerated Five. I want to listen to a clip now from that special. Here's Yusuf Salam on one of the Exonerated Five, who was actually, his case was quite different and separate from the rest, Corey Wise.
Not only will the world get an opportunity to see us for the first time, but we got an opportunity to see each other. We never spoke about or discussed how our experiences were. We had made assumptions that we had gone through the same exact thing. And I think it was important for us to be able to really see the trauma of 30 years, these individual stories, but also the amazing piece of a puzzle, I would say, this magic that Corey has. That here he wasn't even a suspect. And he goes down and he becomes the absolute thing that freed us.
That's Yusuf Salam in conversation with Oprah Winfrey and Ava DuVernay in When They See Us Now, a special interview follow-up to the four-part series When They See Us. It tells Yusuf's story and that of the others who were wrongfully accused and wrongfully convicted in the Central Park Five case. Series currently one of the most watched on Netflix, and I'm talking about it with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, what do you think accounts for the fact that it had this kind of groundswell of interest in this? So many people are watching it and talking about it. Now, it's not the first time we've talked about it.
It's a compelling story. It's a story that, as you know, was mentioned earlier, you know, because of this Sarah Burns documentary, more attention was given to it at that point in time. I think because many young African Americans know of the case because of Donald Trump's presidency, it has a certain kind of appeal. But ultimately, it comes down to really compelling storytelling. And it aligns with so many of our concerns at this point in time about mass incarceration, about unfair convictions, what happens to black boys in the context of everyday life, you know, that gets them on this kind of prison pipeline situation. And I think it's important to remember in terms of Netflix, you know, we can think about the social justice component of this, right? We can think about Ava DuVernay's 13th. We can think about a bunch of things that Netflix does. You know, Netflix is not a group of philanthropists, right? They are not doing this because they are committed to social justice. They're doing this because they saw a compelling story with an amazing storyteller that they knew would get them an audience, right? And in that case, it's a win-win for us because we get to tell the story and we get to see who they are. I mean, the beautiful part of it is for them to sit down with Oprah and tell their own stories now. And I know Yusuf Salam has just attracted major support in terms of representation, so he'll be going all around the globe now.
Mark Anthony Neal is James B. Duke, Distinguished Professor and Chair in the Department of African and African American Studies. He will be back with Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. As Back Channel continues on The State of Things, stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Back Channel today, our recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Let's turn now to the recent news story. Here in North Carolina, a private outdoor recreation center in Wake County under fire for what some are calling racist pool rules. They shared a post on Facebook earlier this month that detailed the rules, which included no baggy pants, no dreadlocks, weaves, extensions, or revealing clothes would be permitted. We will ask you to leave. So, Mark, I know you've looked into this and you've written about this story. Tell us more.
Pool, private-owned pool, you know, you have to have membership to go to it. But they had a list of rules that apparently had been up there for some time, and very specifically around sagging of the pants and no locks and other things with hair. And, you know, the pool owner said those rules for him were not racist, right? They were just to make the pool, you know, process, the swimming process safe. But again, when you consider who's sagging, you know, who wears locks and
who has extensions.
Extensions. And in some ways it's ridiculous because if you are a black woman who has extensions or weave, guess what you're not doing?
You're not getting in the pool. That's right.
which suggested the rules weren't even based in any kind of reality. And I was watching it, and my reaction to it was very whimsical. I was like, okay, that's kind of ridiculous. But my 16-year-old who has locks is sitting there, and she had such a visceral response to it where she just was like, clearly that is racist. And I can remember stories with her at the YMCA here where someone pulled her aside and said, you can't get in the pool with your locks. And she's like looking at the woman like, what are you talking about, right? And it has everything to do with perceptions about black people's bodies and their hair and the difference of it. You know, black women in going through TSA in the airport face the same kind of issues. And so it comes to a head locally for us, at least in the context of this case.
Listen, in my subdivision, I cringe when my kids want to go to the pool because we live in an area that is predominantly white, and you know, it's almost like time stops when we walk into the pool. You know, and I happen to have locks, so I don't even know, you know, clearly I'm not welcome. But it is something about these black bodies, whether they're little teenage or grade school bodies or big people black bodies, folk just are not willing to accommodate. You know, the black presence really anywhere, but there are specific places where, you know, people do come up with rules that are ridiculous, but you know, that are meant to keep us out. You know, it's not like we don't know that. You know, it's clear that that's what's going on. But it's both on the one hand, in 2019, like it makes no sense, right? But at the same time, because of the era we live in, because of who is in office, because of all the ways that bias and racism has just come out in the open, and people don't even try and hide it anymore. They don't even try to pretend. It makes perfect sense.
And we've weaponized these kind of random white folks, you know, at various places trying to police black behavior. And the larger historical point that Natalie talks about, you know, it's the 55th anniversary this week of the situation in St. Augustine, Florida, where they're doing this wade in and this man throws acid into the pool. You know, for older generation of blacks who see this recent story, right, that's the first thing they think about, right? Mm-hmm. This larger history of trying to keep blacks out of particular places.
Yeah, well, and talk about this moment, because I think that it's interesting. You know, the owners of the pool say, well, we didn't mean to be racist, but we heard from somebody that this would clog up our filter and therefore we didn't do it. Now, there's been some fact-checking around. I mean, they may have heard from some people. Nobody else has heard from the same people.
Right.
So nobody knows who they were talking to because it doesn't seem to check out very well.
Right.
If you know anything about pools and filters. But
hair is hair.
Right.
You know, so it's not like only black people's hair would kind of fall out and clog up the pool.
But talk more about in this moment and what that means, because we are more sensitive. You've got to be tone deaf to understand that if you say dreadlocks and baggy pants, you know, like at this point, you know who you're just targeting as right. the owners.
It's dog whistles, right?
Absolutely.
It's a dog whistle.
That's my point is now it's like a trombone, you know? So what I'm saying is that we're using this stuff now. It's not right. even that you're actually, this is your way of telling your group
right.
that well, I guess that's
you're trying to protect the space.
Right. And there's no interest in understanding. See, that I think is a part of the underlying problem. Like, there's no cultural understanding. Right. As someone who wears locks, I can tell you, this is my hair. It's not going to come out just because I get in the water, right? You know, and it's no different.
It's not going to dissolve.
It's not going to, exactly. So there's no way that it's going to have an impact on the pool's ability to operate, right. the engine, you know, the motor, any of that. But there's a willful ignorance that exists. People don't want to know.
Yeah.
And a certain kind of class perception, right? Which is why your family is an interesting dynamic here, right? Because what you have are folks who are saying, well, if we're going to have black folks, they have to look a certain kind of way. And the perceptions that that's class. So if you're an upper middle class black person, you obviously wouldn't have locks, right? And your kids wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't have a wave. Your kids wouldn't be sagging and all those kinds of things.
And that is far from the case.
Right. Well, and again, getting back to the earlier conversation, what it means you have to bear. Now your choice is, do I go to this pool, fight the fight, or look white, or not go to the pool?
And what happens is now black folks' hair and how they wear their clothes becomes the new paper bag test.
That's right.
Hey, let's turn to Spike Lee's 1989 film, Do the Right Thing, turns 30 this summer, follows residents in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn on a hot day, hottest day of the year, centers at Sal's Pizzeria, Italian-American-owned restaurant, black neighborhood, tensions emerge. Let's listen to a clip from the film.
Hey, Sal, how come you got no brothers on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Take it easy,
huh? And you.
Hey. Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some set.
Mookie, you want to get your friend out of here?
Well, you going to kick me out now? Or you going to kick me out, huh?
No, I'm not kicking you out. You're kicking yourself out.
What? Look, we got some brothers up on the wall, you know? Malcolm Epps, Nelson Mandela, you know, Michael Jordan. Tomorrow.
Come on, Mookie, get him out, all right?
I'm trying to get him out. I paid for life. I know you paid for it. Let's go. Yeah, all right, all right. So kicking me out. Beat me in the head and gonna kick me out, right?
Come on, let's
go. Yeah, okay, bet. Yeah, all right. I paid for my. Look, boycott Sal.
Let's
go.
Right?
Yo, boycott Sal.
I got your boycott swinging.
Boycott Sal. Yo, man, what you laughing at?
There it is, a scene from Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee's 1989 film, turns 30 this year. Talking about it with Natalie Bullard Brown and Mark Anthony Neal.
I'm just thinking about when this film came out. I think it was 1989, right?
The same summer the Central Park Five, right?
Right. And so I was in college. I was a sophomore, I believe. And, you know, there was a lot of, like, political awakening, racial awakening that was going on the campus of Northwestern University amongst black students, me in particular. And I just remember this being like a, you know, what do you call it? A call. What's the call?
An epiphany, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. There's some sort of call, but it's a wake-up call. Yeah. Sorry. Because I just wasn't aware of the ways that race worked, you know, the ways that that these dynamics exist, the power dynamics, like all this stuff is so embedded in Do the Right Thing. And so now, 30 years later, you know, looking back at it, I see what Spike was doing in a much more clear way. I have a lot of respect for him because he was prophetic in what he did. In not only in what was going on at the time, which in retrospect feels like it wasn't that bad, but when you think about what we're dealing with now, it is the same exact thing. Nothing has changed. And so that's really, you know, I think a testament to Spike's brilliance, his ability to put his finger on the pulse of what was happening racially in America and his commentary on it. But also that, you know, he was saying something to us then that it so deserved the types of awards that it did not get, you mm-hmm. know? And you know, I really take my hat off to Spike because he was on to something.
Mark?
It's a time when Spike Lee films, the release of Spike Lee films were like the release of Black Panther, where everybody had
That's
to
right.
get out that first weekend because you had to guarantee that enough folks went out that it would go to more theaters the following week.
Yep.
And he's capturing a tone, a feel in New York City. Michael Griffith being chased by racist mobs in 1986. The older woman who was killed by New York City police, mm-hmm. you know, in her apartment. The graffiti artist Michael Stewart, who's killed after he dies in police custody. Tawana Brawley. Right. You know, who's also this case of sexual violence against a black woman. It's all coded in the film.
Yeah.
Right.
And
so there's like an anger that's built in, so much of an anger that you had many pundits that were afraid that if black folks went to see the film, that it would cause riots.
Yep.
To have Public Enemy do the anthem from the movie Fight the Power, which became a rallying cry for a generation of black folks that we heard continually on in Ferguson and other places,
right.
you know, almost 30 years later, I think it by far is the high point. I would even say even more so than Malcolm X, the high point because of its impact on the culture.
Yeah.
Was Spike Lee doing Do the Right Thing and what it meant to us? It anticipates, you know, the when we see Radio Raheem killed at the end, the late Bill Nunn. It literally anticipates Eric Garner.
Right? Yes.
The same kinds of images, right? He is so dead on about gentrification in ways that we did not understand in 1989 that makes so much sense, whether it's in Bed-Stuy or in Durham.
Right.
30
right.
years later, he right. was on the cutting edge of that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to change now, too. Change subjects and turn to another film. Our last topic, a new Netflix documentary, The Black Godfather. It tells the story of music executive and North Carolina native Clarence Avant.
This name kept coming up.
Who is this guy that I keep hearing about?
He wasn't there, but he was right there.
The record business, Hollywood, civil rights, anything that had to do with the rights of people.
That told you everything you needed to know about him.
He's a fearless man, absolutely fearless.
We needed to know him because he was the gatekeeper.
He knew everyone.
Everybody.
Oh man, he was too fly.
One day after another, he became a powerhouse.
There's the power that needs the spotlight, but there's also the power behind the scenes.
The guy's a rock in every way.
Agent, manager,
orchestrator,
this mysterious figure everybody respected.
You only find one of those people.
I'm like, how is this guy doing it?
Sometimes I say to myself, how in the f*** did I get involved in all this?
Trailer from the Netflix documentary The Black Godfather tells the story of music executive Clarence Avant. He's also a North Carolina native who went to work with artists and politicians from Barack Obama, Bill Withers, Snoop Dogg, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, tell us more about this.
So the fact that Clarence Avant's been doing this for 60 years and they could make a documentary, and how many folks watched a documentary and it's like, I've never heard of this man before in my life.
Right, right? Here.
Sorry.
Know, the almost like the very definition of the spook who sat beside the door,
yeah.
right? But he's been this kind of backroom mover and shaker for a long time. I begin to know about him in the 1980s because of the handprint that he and another gentleman by the name of Dick Griffey had on 1980s R&B music through their labels Taboo, you know, which is where he first began to work with Jam and Lewis. It's also where he begins to work with a group called the SOS Band, Alexander McNeil, and then Dick Griffey with Solar Records with L.A. Reid and Babyface. And I often wondered who this guy was, right? And so you go back and you realize he had this little label called Sus. And it is Success that took a chance on a 30-year-old airplane mechanic by the name of Bill Withers, right, and turned him into an international star. But he was never just satisfied with doing that, right? He was literally this kind of power broker that would connect powerful white people to talented black folks and create a context in which things would move and change and shift.
Mm-hmm. So I knew about Clarence Avant, my understanding of who he was and the role that he's played in all of these artists was very superficial, because I would hear his name. You know, I heard it around P. Diddy, Puffy back in the day, and it was almost like a passing thing. I was like, who is that? okay, you know, yeah, apparently he's powerful, but I don't really know what he does. Yeah. I don't know, you know, where he works. You know, I mean, he just seemed to be ubiquitous, just everywhere. And so watching this documentary was a delight to find out finally, you know, what his role has been and how powerful he was, right? Because
he's still here.
He's still here.
Still going.
Yes. Oh, thank God.
And you talk about artists, but it's artists and politicians. Let's listen.
Yeah.
There's a guy running for Congress. We've been the first black guy from the South. Andy really didn't know me. I really didn't know him. So I call Andy.
He called up and he said, "You Andy Young?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You running for Congress?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "In Georgia?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Nigga, are you crazy?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I probably am." He said, "Well, if you're crazy enough to run, I'm crazy enough to try to help you."
I apologize. I should have given us all a warning in advance that there is
an
offensive and painful word. So forgive me for not
giving
that
warning.
But it was
so apropos in the context of what he was describing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But we talk about the fact that, and we've only got a few seconds left, what it does is explain kind of who he is and what he did, but the secret sauce is like the how.
The how. Yes.
Right.
That's
magic, right?
He was someone who understood relationships.
Yes.
I mean, that's what it all really comes. I mean, those are the kind of folks who understand relationships, how to put people in conversation with. Anytime you do a documentary where you can get two former presidents and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama to be in a documentary,
right,
that gives you some level of the kind of respect that he had, let alone Berry Gordy and Quincy Jones and all these other folks who show up.
Yeah, he's a kingmaker. And it's so clear that people, you know, across spectrums respect him, look up to him. And, you know, I would not want to be his kids, because to have to share him with people, is like, you know.
But always a living room full of interesting people.
Absolutely.
Natalie Bullock Brown is filmmaker and a teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal is James B. Duke Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. A program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hullab-Mormon. Also, Robin Copley, she is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.